A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host for this journey into issues facing the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues these organizations are facing. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll hear a story of challenge, persistence, and resilience. My guest will be Andrea Avery, who was just 12 years old and a budding pianist when she was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. She's written a book about her experiences, and she'll talk about how living with a chronic illness altered her life's trajectory and about the roles that music has played throughout that journey. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Mark Hansen, Executive Director and CEO of the Houston Symphony Orchestra, has been named Executive Director of the San Francisco Symphony. During his 7 years with the Houston Symphony, Hansen oversaw the creation of several community engagement initiatives, such as a community-embedded musician program through which several of its string players worked directly with area school children in music education, and leadership councils that sought to develop closer ties with the region's African-American, Hispanic, and Asian communities. Hansen, who will take on his new role in September, takes over for Brent Asink, who left in March after 18 years. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. Andrea Avery had been playing piano for about 5 years when she began to feel that she might just make it her career. She was 12 and looking forward not only to her piano playing, but also to all of the other things that life holds in store for a teenage girl. Then she was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, and suddenly every aspect of her life, from gym class to dating to family trips, were fraught with new and unexpected detours and roadblocks. These obstacles could bring pain and disappointment, but they also posed dares and challenges from which she did not often shrink. While Avery was ultimately unable to pursue her piano career, music has continued to be a recurring theme in her life, particularly Schubert's Sonata in B-flat, the last piano sonata he ever wrote. Avery has chronicled her efforts to navigate these unpredictable paths and her still challenged relationship with music in her new book, Sonata, A Memoir of Pain and the Piano, published by Pegasus Books. I spoke with her recently about the book, her persistence, and the ways in which music figures in her life today. How long have you had this book in the back of your mind, or this idea for this type of book?
Yeah, that's a nice question. I think the answer I settle on is 10 years. It was about 10 years ago that I started heading to Starbucks after work to start putting words on the page. And the reason I did so was that a teacher, I was writing terrible fiction at the time. I was writing a novel that was deservedly shelved. And, you know, a former teacher at that point said, you really need to write the book that you want to read. And I thought, this novel that I'm writing, I don't even want to read it. Why would anyone else? And then I thought, the book I really want to read doesn't actually exist. The book that I would have liked to read when I was 17 or 19, that depicted, you know, being chronically ill and trying to have a boyfriend or trying to forge a career. That book, I had never found that book. So it was when that teacher gave me that piece of advice around 2007 that I started, okay, well, let me just start. And so I started, like I said, going to Starbucks after work and just starting somewhere, just starting to tell it and then figuring out how it could shape together into a book.
Well, now you write throughout the book about how arthritis, the disease, the condition has affected, in some ways, dictated the way that other people view you and, in fact, the way that you've maneuvered through your life. How did you bring those strands together into the book to demonstrate that, but then also maybe to kind of break the mold, break those right. stereotypes and expectations?
Well, for a while in the initial stages of writing the book, I struggled with, am I writing a book about arthritis or am I writing a book about music? And when I discovered in the writing that the tension between them was not something I needed to resolve, that it was the story is the tension between them, then I got a lot happier with the idea of writing an arthritis book. In the book I talk about, and in my life I've talked about, my sort of ambivalence about how much I want to belong to this arthritis community, or even how much I want to claim the title of disabled for myself. And I can't say that that's a question that's fully resolved for me even now. I go back and forth on it and about it. But it was in discovering that I didn't have to set aside arthritis to write a book about the main love of my life, which is music, and that I didn't have to set aside music to write about the central problem of my life, which is arthritis, that I kind of claimed the arthritis or disabled identity for myself a little more happily, because I realized it could coexist with music in a written form, even though they couldn't figure out a way to coexist in my actual life. Arthritis has made it hard for me to be a musician, but I can write a book where they are both present and neither one has to go away to make room for the other one.
Hmm. Well, now you were diagnosed at the age of 12, mm-hmm. about the time that the music really had become a passion for yeah. you. And yet it's a long struggle getting kind of, even first of all, just acknowledging that there's going to be any overlap in intersection. Right. Tell us a little bit about that process, especially as a young person, right. and how you started to see that this new reality mm-hmm. was going to play a role and was going to affect this passion of yours, this music.
Yeah, 12 was an interesting and sort of fraught age to be diagnosed with arthritis, because, when you're 12, you're a little bit older than a 6 or 7 year old who's pretty good at the piano. When you're 12, and I know this because I'm a teacher of teenagers now, so I see this all the time. But 12, 13, 14, 15, you're starting to sort out what aspects of your life that were once after school programs or hobbies or things are actually going to be able to be in your life. Like, am I good enough at this that I could, do this? And so it's around 12 where you're really starting to envision the adult you want to be, or at least I was. And so to have this crash appearance of arthritis to complicate things, it was particularly fraught, although I don't think I acknowledged that until much later. I think if I'd gotten arthritis at 4, 5, or 6, which happens, I may never have started the piano. Or if I'd gotten it the year after I started piano, maybe someone would have said, maybe not good to put all your eggs in that basket. Maybe not, maybe somebody would have cautioned me to, start writing earlier or something. But by 12, and I describe this in the book, it was a head start. Piano already had me, and it had me for 5 years. So to get this potentially devastating, potentially crippling disease at a time when I was so far gone into piano that it was not only my favorite hobby and my favorite pastime and my favorite, it was a part of my identity. I don't know that I knew then how the arthritis was going to complicate things. It was many years before I kind of conceded that arthritis was gonna complicate the music ambitions. I eked out a degree in music, and it felt like that. It felt like sort of getting away with something, because by then I kind of had exhausted my head start. I mean, it's an interesting time to get ill at 12. I was, at the doorstep of puberty. I was, trying to get my own independence from my parents in so many age-appropriate ways. I want to go out with my friends. I want to, I've been boy crazy since I was little. I really wanted to start forging my own way at 12. And then I got this thing that was going to make that way complicated and was really going to imperil how much music I was going to be able to make along the way.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting in some ways, because it was through the first conference you went to mm-hmm. where you were introduced to a piece of music mm-hmm. that would in some ways become a central focus yeah. of your musical experience. Schubert. Tell us about the Schubert Sonata.
It wasn't at the very first conference. And I know that because I'm astounded by the poetry that life throws at you if you're paying attention. I encountered that Schubert Sonata, the one in B flat, in a city called Providence, which, I mean, it just, if you wrote that into a book, somebody would say, it's a little much, Andrea, dial it back. Don't call it Providence. Have it take place somewhere else like Denver. But it was in Providence that I was at a conference for kids with arthritis. Again, my ambivalence was showing because I wasn't sure how many of the actual sessions I wanted to go to. I was kind of tentative about my membership in this crowd. But the art therapy session sounded really like my kind of thing. And it was, you know, a room in a banquet room in a conference facility in a hotel. And it was really cold, as they always are, super air conditioned. And there was like paper and we were left alone to make stuff. And I know in the book it sounds a little disparaging, like I'm calling that not true art therapy. But to this day, I think it's very therapeutic to be left alone in a room to make stuff. But, you know, I was sitting there and there was this boombox playing and this piece of piano music started playing. And it just, you know, it just immediately captured me. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know who wrote it. I only knew that it was piano music and that I played the piano. And I was very arrogant. And I said to, you know, my fellow arthritic kids, I can play this. And it was a lie because I didn't know who wrote it. I never played it. But it sounded like it was within my reach. You know, when you're a pianist, or I imagine it's true of any instrument, you can kind of hear, yeah, that's in my range. I can do that. But I waited till the end. And, you know, I've been trained, grew up listening to classical music radio with my parents in the car and things. So I knew you waited till the end, multiple movements, and they would tell you what it was. And I wrote it down on a scrap of paper. And when I got home, I found the sheet music and I didn't know anything about this sonata. I didn't really care about Schubert. I was into much flashier, sexier composers, I think. And this piece of music has been my accompaniment throughout my life since then. I've listened to it at different eras of my life for different reasons. I listened to it back then to try to learn how to play it. I started to study it in a more authentic musical way when I wanted to go beyond mimicking what I heard in the recording and making my own rendition of it. It became sort of a very mournful musical experience for me at the periods of my life when I was unable to play the piano like I am now. So in those moments, it's been sort of excruciating to listen to. But then I also discovered all the scholarship around it and all the writing about it. And I learned about the circumstances of Schubert's life when he wrote it, sick and dying and aware of his dying. And then I learned, you know, that I just had lunch with the professor Joseph Strauss, and he's written a book about disability in music. And when I encountered his analysis, his harmonic analysis of that sonata, my sonata, where he's reading it as a kind of musical metaphor for disability, where unlike a Beethoven sonata, where it would have to be resolved heroically by the end, a Schubert sonata has this kind of harmonic ailment in it and says, well, we're going to let it be and figure out how to work with it, how to accommodate this disability. To think that I encountered a piece of music in a conference room in Providence as a kid and just thought it was a piece of music and then chased it and exhausted my ability to play the piano kind of in homage to this sonata and then emerged into reading about it and reading the scholarship about it and then being encouraged to write about it. I mean, this sonata has kept me company through a long, tough stretch of years. So it is, you know, without exception, my favorite piece of music, which isn't to say I can always listen to it happily. Sometimes it devastates me.
Well, as you referred to also, Schubert was facing many of his own struggles. And as you recount in the book, both pointing to Schubert and also Wittgenstein, mm-hmm. They sort of become touchstones, not icons for you, but what did these two musicians, these two artistic personalities represent for you through your journey?
Well, it's funny because in both cases, my initial meeting of them, now Schubert I'd met before I met the sonata. I met Schubert I played March Militare with my sister in a double piano version or a duet version. And I had heard his songs and I was not too jazzed about Schubert up to that point. So my first meeting of Schubert, like my first encounter of Paul Wittgenstein, was one of rejection, of not my kind of thing. And I think your question was about what do they represent to me. They represent myself. And my first reaction was, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be the sick, tragic, syphilitic songwriter, composer whose sonatas people don't think are as good as his forebears, as good as Beethoven's, you know? I don't want to be the one-armed pianist who is staring back at me out of this black and white picture that I encountered in a music library when I was forced to find left-handed literature because my right hand was in a sling. You know, my first initial reaction to both these people was, that's not what I want to be. I want to be an actual pianist. I want the sterling trajectory and the unqualified, you know, success. And I never had that overt reaction to my own illness or my own body. Like, I don't want to have arthritis. I never kicked and screamed and cried and said, but mommy, I don't want to have rheumatoid arthritis. I just took it in stride. But I think my initial rejection of both of these musicians, Schubert and Wittgenstein, was, I think, a manifestation of my rejection of, I don't want to be filed away this way. I don't want to be remembered this way. I don't want arthritis and my disability to be the most memorable thing about me. I don't want that to be my legend. I want to be a pianist. But both of them have seen me through that negotiation and that accommodation and that acceptance of, well, I'm going to be this. I have arthritis and it's not going anywhere. So I've got to figure out how to be a person I like with it and to make something worthwhile, not just despite it, but using it. And as I accepted that about myself, I accepted, you know, I learned more about Schubert and I learned, you know, I sort of stick up for Schubert whenever people are like, well, he's not as good as Beethoven. Like, well, you're simplistic if you think so. You're not listening very carefully. He's not trying to be Beethoven. And Paul Wittgenstein, too, the more I learned about him, that House of Wittgenstein book, which is a wonderful book that people should read about his, you know, his, it's about the whole family. It's not purely about him, but about his pursuit of being a musician, even after he lost his arm. I thought, well, these can be my heroes. I don't need to reject them on the basis of their disfigurements or their shortcomings. I can love them for everything they've done with and alongside those things. And if I can love them for that, maybe I can love myself for that too.
Well, now you also write that at some point, despite your trying initially not to categorize yourself mm-hmm. and have yourself seen that way, that ultimately, in some ways, the disease has become, I think you called it the premise. It's a part of you. And yet within that, it's something that you seem to have taken. And as you write, it's changed you for good. Yeah. Explain that a little bit for maybe people who yeah. haven't been through something like this and
right.
don't quite understand where you're coming and from
I,
on it.
Yeah, I like this question because I think sometimes people are skeptical. They think, well, certainly you would give back arthritis if you could. Like if you could go back to 1988 and not have it, you would, right? And I'm not a Pollyanna-ish kind of person. I'm not a, you know, sunshine and lollipops person all the time. But the answer is truly no. You know, I think I'm better at, or at least more contented, and I have more to offer in writing than I perhaps did as a musician. And I don't know that I would have found my way to that if I didn't have this struggle, this problem to figure out, this identity to negotiate. Well, in addition to giving me a crash course and letting me gain entrance into rooms where people were talking about disability theory and opening my eyes to there are many ways to go about the world in a body, and there's not this one normative ideal, and anybody who is short of it is broken or wrong. So it has bought me entry into those spaces to learn about that. I think it has endowed me with more compassion. Generally, you know, people are doing the best they can with what they have. I don't know that I would believe that if I hadn't lived exactly what I've lived so far. Imperiling my music the way it has made me a better listener to music. Because when I was obsessed with playing and performing and this idea that I could dazzle people, I'm not sure I was a very good audience member. I'm not sure I was a very good listener. I was always just waiting for my turn. Now, since I don't have a turn, I can listen better. So I think that I really wouldn't get rid of it. If, you know, I wouldn't go back and opt to have a life without this in it. I'm safe to say that because it's not an option. So, you know, this is all in the realm of the imaginary. So I'm not in any danger. Nobody's going to call in, I think, and say, well, I could take it away for her. So I am safe to say that. But I like the person I've become with it. And I have to believe that the person I've become with it is partly because of it, at least partly because of it, and not just despite it. And so if I like where I am, why would I trade anything that got me here? As painful as it is to have let music go away to the extent that it has, what else would I have written a book about at 40 if I hadn't had this? I mean, that, I got nothing. I guess this is my story. You know, I don't know if I had to have a past story by now.
You did ultimately lose at least what you had dreamed for,
right,
in terms of your music. At the same time, though, you write, you've pondered that having had the music, especially something as dexterous as mm-hmm. piano, in some ways, as you quote Byron Janis, yeah, having noted that in some ways the piano probably helped you through all of that at a time. And tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I think in a purely logistical way it did. I mean, I spent years going to physical therapy, and you know, you can move pegs to a pegboard over and over, and that'll preserve some range of motion and some dexterity, or you can work through your book of hand and exercises, and you know, I think that's better. So I think having piano to play kept my fingers moving. Arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, is very much a disease of attrition. If you don't move things, they freeze up and you won't be able to move them. So playing all that piano kept my fingers moving. It was also very, very hard on my hands, and it caused things to tear and to rupture. But, you know, just from a pure dexterity standpoint, I was moving them a lot for a lot of years. And I think that's good. The other thing it did is it trained me in problem solving, which arthritis in general has done. Arthritis is this great big problem solving task. There's 10 things a day that I have to figure out a way to do differently to get them done if I want to go about the world, like swiping a credit card in those ridiculous machines that are always difficult to use. And so I often have to figure out if I can pinch it like this or hold it like that. So it was at the piano that I first had to figure out alternative ways of doing things, alternative ways of fingering scales, or you know, alternative ways of voicing a chord, or alternative ways of doing figured bass when I played harpsichord. And so that's carried over, that problem solving. There's got to be a different way I can do this and still get something out of it. And also it's shown me that bodies are pretty resilient. Your body is so smart, or at least mine is. I think other people's are too. And it can come up with really ingenious ways to make things you didn't think it could. So I think the piano gave me a laboratory to both extend and cultivate my problem-solving skills, but also a chance to see my body do things that other people would probably think were impossible. But my body's like, no, I got this. I can figure this out. So that's good. The flip side is that Byron Janis's quote is that, you know, arthritis is not good for the piano, but piano is good for arthritis. I think that's, I always think of it in the reverse. But playing all those hours at the piano did cause a lot of damage.
What role does music play in your life today?
A complicated one. I love it. I struggle with my identity as a musician because I don't know if I am one anymore, which is hard to even say out loud, right? Because it was the thing I always claimed. I always tell my students, I'm a teacher and I'm a writer, and I tell my students, the writer is the person who wrote today, which is a line I cribbed from a teacher, like all my best lines. So if a writer is the person who wrote today, if you don't need to wait to be bopped on the head by a magic wand, or you don't need to get a degree, you don't need someone to tell you you're a writer, you put words on the page today, you're a writer. Okay, so is the musician the person who made music today? Because I can't make music. I listen to it very carefully. I like to listen to classical music stations and sort of mimic my college education. Who do I think wrote this? What hallmarks do I recognize? What key is it in? Blah, 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 you know. So I think I'm a very careful, good listener to music, but I struggle with whether I can still claim to be a musician or not. And sometimes listening to straight up piano music is very, very painful because it hits a little too close to home, especially if it's like an echo of that day when I first heard the Schubert, that sense that like, ooh, this is within my reach, I could do this. If I hear a piece of music that feels like it's supposed to be within my reach and then I look down at my hands, it's too hard. So it's like, the way I describe it is, okay, I had an excerpt run in the Washington Post and then it got syndicated by another paper. And the title they put on it was, After Rheumatoid Arthritis, Young Pianist's Dream Dies. And I thought, is it dead? So of course I went straight to the comments and commented, I hope you'll read the book to find out whether it's actually dead or not. It's not dead. It's abducted. Death is a closure. If I could just not play piano at all anymore and it was for sure gone, then maybe I could listen to piano literature. I could go to piano concerts and I could be very happy. But it's more like it's abducted. And I don't know if it's coming back. I don't know if I'll recognize it when it comes back. I don't know if it'll still love me when it comes back. So listening to straight kind of piano literature of the type that I loved the most is very, very hard. So I tend to listen more to, of course, I still listen to a lot of pop music. I listen to classic rock that my brother tutored me in. And I love to listen to early music. And I love to listen to instruments that I never had a claim on playing, trumpet and cello and things that I think, ooh, what's it like to be able to play that? That I really enjoy. Piano's a little too hard.
I did want to ask you to read an excerpt of the book, and it was really hard to choose because there's so many beautiful passages. But there's one when you talk towards the end about getting to a point where you felt you could play again, and you have that piano that your parents bought for you when you were younger and then had to sit in storage. You have it shipped over to you. And so if you can pick just the two paragraphs here about what it was like getting back to that.
For 2 long weeks, the piano was nowhere, on a truck in the middle of the country, and then it appeared. The piano movers had a big German shepherd that had traveled with them across the country. The dog took a nap on one of the blue quilted blankets. I took pictures as the piano was unshrouded, as its legs were screwed back on, as it was set upright. After the movers left, before I let the cats out of the bedroom, I lifted the lid and I turned to Chopin, to the funeral march I hadn't known enough sadness to play. I picked it out, reading slowly at first, and then realizing that my hands had been through so much, still knew this. My fingers knew where to look for the notes, even if they couldn't reach them. My tendons, which had been severed and sewn, did their job. It was true. I'd had no business at all playing this music at 14. But now I knew it had been played at Chopin's own funeral and at John F. Kennedy's. Better, I thought, to have awkward hands but a heart and brain that worked. Now I thrill at playing the music that disappointed me before, the Chopin etude I botched on the piano exam. I open my old harpsichord music and play it on the piano, grateful for music that fits in my hands but challenges my brain. Without music like this, if there were only Liszt, I'd be shut out. I'd have nothing to play. As soon as my fingers reacquaint themselves with my piano, they clamor for Schubert, the sonata, the piece of music I love more than any other. There may be a reason this sonata spoke to me and still continues to speak to me. And that's where I go into explaining Dr. Strauss's analysis of that sonata in his book, Extraordinary Measures. I'm a teacher. I can't help but make book recommendations as I go. So that's my second one. Everybody should read Extraordinary Measures.
Well, Andrea, thank you so much for joining us and for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Andrea Avery, author of Sonata, A Memoir of Pain and the Piano. You can find more information at pegasusbooks.com/books. I hope you enjoy these conversations I bring you about music and the arts every week on A Tempo. Remember that programs like this on the Classical Network are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. You can listen to past programs of A Tempo by going to our arts and cultural news page at wwfm.org or searching for A Tempo on our program page. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.